Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is the Page Publishing Book Club. How you doing? I'm Alice Stockton Rossini. As an active funeral celebrant, Teresa Wirth was already helping grieving families when she got the idea for her anthology entitled Navigating the Pandemic, Stories of Hope and Resilience.
Because I work with families all the time, helping them on their grief journey, I recognized early in the pandemic that every single thing each of us was losing was registering within us as grief. And so we all had layer upon layer upon layer of grief. You know, we lost the ability to gather, to travel, to shop, to celebrate, to go to school, all those things. And so I was really struck by how are people going to manage this? They have never, ever experienced this before. They don't recognize it, and they don't know what to do about it. The 39 writers are all professional, non-professional writers, ages 18 to 80, who have an experience that relates to the pandemic. And so they either shared their professional experience or their personal experience. And I call this a lifetime of networking. You know, I called in a lot of favors of people that I've met over the years and asked people to write and gave them the parameters, and people donated their work, and we created this anthology. We have 51 stories and 51 black and white images, and we have 39 writers from 18 to 80 from 11 states and 6 countries.
That's amazing.
It truly is. I'm very proud of our book, really.
So do any of these stories stick out for you? Is there one, give me an example of one that I will find that resonated with you?
There's one story that says, we're all in the same storm, but we're not in the same boat. And that was widely circulated, that little phrase, on social media in the beginning of the pandemic. And there actually is a story written by Damien Barr of Great Britain about that. And the point being, yes, we were all in the same storm, but we were all experiencing the pandemic differently. There were these huge disparities between how people were experiencing this. And so it was important to me to find writers to represent all those different groups of people, migrant farm workers, the elderly, the incarcerated, LGBTQ people, veterans, teachers, students, artists. So there's this whole array of insights into the pandemic experience. That's why it's hard to say any one, because there wasn't a universal common thing, except that none of us had experienced it before. This is not a political book. It's a human book. It's a human story. It has historical significance because our grandchildren's grandchildren can take this book and tell them, show them what the first several months of the pandemic were like for us. But I did not want it to be a political book. And there certainly was a giant political side to the pandemic. And we did not discuss that at all. We discussed strictly the human aspect of it. So the story about what happened in the Ohio State Correctional System with one of the prisoners who wrote a rap for our book, or what happened with the homeless man that Jim Sutton wrote about that he dealt with as a physician assistant, or what happened in the nursing home that Maria Sutton visited 3 times a week. You know, those stories are real. They are what they are. And I can only offer those up as people's experiences.
So as a PR person, how are you putting the word out?
We're promoting our book through social media. I give presentations at churches, civic groups, book clubs, libraries. We have a website. We have a wonderful website, dandelionbook.com. And we're just trying to share it. I think a lot of people buy it and read it, and then they give it you know, a lot of people gave it at Christmas time because some of the reviewers who read the draft manuscript said this should be in everybody's family library because it's important historical information. The most common comment was that it made people feel less alone because they read about someone who had an experience similar to theirs. The other thing I would like to say, our book is a nonprofit humanitarian project. We looked and looked for a charity partner, and all of the great big Feeding America and Doctors Without Borders and all, that's who I would have chosen to be our partner. But I would have had to guarantee $5,000 to $10,000 to $50,000 donation in the first year. And I had no illusions that we were going to sell that money. This was not going to be a New York Times bestseller, but I found the Society for Refugee Healthcare Providers, and they were more than happy to be our charity partners. We were able to use their logo and spread their cause. And then, unbeknownst to any of us, 600,000 plus Afghan refugees were resettling around the world. And this is an organization who helps those people get health care. And so it turned out to be very relevant to the pandemic. And we're delighted that all of our profits are going to the Society for Refugee Healthcare Providers.
That is great work, Teresa. Thank you so much. A retired cop living in Iowa, Michael Egbert, shares law enforcement stories worthy of a true crime show in his fourth book with Paige, a reprint of his first book from 20 years ago with a new chapter added. It's entitled Special Crime Attack Team, based on a real crime team created during the 70s.
It's a story about how we worked undercover as police officers because, you know, crime problem. And so they formed this law enforcement group called the Special Crime Attack Team, and our job was to crush crime, which we did. And we had to infiltrate these organizations, these groups of criminals and what have you, to try to get enough evidence against them to make an arrest and take them to court and get convictions and what have you. So we did a lot of role playing. This chapter, this one particular chapter I added was, I was a bank president for a week. I was surprised at how easy it was to walk in there and just take over a whole bank. You know, I just thought, well, gee. And this fellow didn't even question it. And we got word that a mafia hit had been put out for him. They found out he was skimming money from him. And apparently he was aware of this because when we came in there with the proposition of me taking his place for a while and try to capture this hitman who was coming in from Europe, nobody knew who it was. And it turned out to be a woman instead of a man, which surprised everybody. And she was apprehended in Chicago going through customs before she had a chance to make it to this bank. So he ended up getting 20 years in prison anyway, so for money laundering.
So you save his life and he goes to prison.
Right. But at least he was alive. It's kind of funny in a way because I was posing as this bank president there. And that very same weekend, probably before all this took place, an actual gangland slaying did take place in town. And I think that's what scared him. And he didn't even question it, which surprised me. Each chapter is a different story. I've worked as a biker one time, an outlaw biker, trying to work on a homicide. I was a wino at another time on a surveillance. And they're all true stories. I just had to change some of the locations and stuff like that because when I was the outlaw biker, all the arrests we made on that deal was most of those guys were sitting on death row, and so I had to be careful how I referred to them in this book because we talked to a lawyer about it and thought, maybe you might want to, you know.
This sounds like a great TV series, Michael.
Well, that's when, you know, when it first came out, that's what they were talking about doing with it.
Who's they?
Some producers out in Hollywood. They just, for some reason, changed their mind or moved on to other projects and whatever. Because it started out with 26 chapters, and they thought, well, that'd be a great TV series, because that's what they usually have, 26 episodes. And each one of these chapters is a different story. And I started out how I got selected for this unit. It was set up by an LEAA grant, which was set up by President Nixon at the time to combat the problem with the crime that they were having at the time. Lo and behold, guess what? We're having a crime problem now. So I found out my biggest danger wasn't the fact that I was working undercover. It was my fellow police officers were a bigger danger.
Why?
Well, say, for example, you're out and about and you got some guy with you that you don't know who he is and you're trying to identify. And suddenly one of your buddies that you know as a police officer sees you and comes walking over there. Hey, Val, what's going on? Carrying on a conversation with you like your old friends and stuff like that. Well, there goes your investigation.
Well, that seems so stupid.
Yeah, but a lot of these officers, they don't realize what they're doing when they do that. So it does happen.
Okay, that's a little scary, Michael, but great stories nonetheless. Thank you. A business owner coach for decades and one-time senior executive in banking and investment advisor, Dr. Robert Gregory brings his wealth of experience to his guide for business startups and existing businesses. And I bet no matter who you're helping, you find similarities when it comes to why businesses fail.
Sure, there are a lot of them, but the top mistakes I have found that most business owners are very good at this skill set. The doctors that I have, the engineers that I have, the IT professionals, they have mechanics, they have a skill set where they know exactly how to do what they do. Unfortunately, they come up with challenges and struggles because they do not know how to run a business. They don't know how to manage their numbers. They don't know about the customer service quirks that you should learn when you're having customers, marketing, advertising. They do very little, have very little knowledge about branding, budgeting, and just kind of watching the business and handling the things underneath the surface that has nothing to do with their skill set, but has everything to do with the business that they're not able to conquer in order to get to the next profit level. They don't train you how to do that in school. They'll teach you a little bit about sales, a little bit about marketing, but you can take that textbook, put it as a book stop at the door, because when you get into business, a lot of things are going to happen that you cannot imagine. And it has nothing to do with their skill set. It's just how business works.
Is it an emergency handbook?
It's a step-by-step. And I started the chapters off, educational chapters leading up until some of the problems and challenges of the business. But it starts off with organization, why you want to be in business. What is your business going to do for you? Is this really a hobby or is this a business? Is this the thing that keeps you up late at night that you cannot go to sleep because you got to get up and do this idea? And I give them ideas of what to think about if you want to create a business and how to do research on the right business to create based on your skill set or other people that are friends or relatives or mentors that can associate with you to help you get a structure for this business you want to start. Then it goes into budgeting and the definition between an LLC and an S-Corp and a C-Corp and a partnership and all those things that they probably don't have the knowledge of unless they pay for it. And then it goes into, marketing. Here's some marketing ideas. Here's the difference between marketing and branding.
I find it so disturbing that so much emphasis is put on how many followers you have, how many clicks you have, because that's how you're judged now.
Yeah, it is. And I was thinking about that in my arena as well. And I'll probably pay a little more attention to it down the road. But I'm working on a radio show now. I will have a business TV show called Let's Talk Business. And in order for me to get discovered and to get the attention and to get the sponsors that I need, they're going to look at how many followers I have. I mean, I'm not going to be on the network if I got 50 people and my social media followers, they want to know what I'm bringing to the table. What's my skin in the game?
So I guess with all of this knowledge, you know what to do with your book, right? How to push it out there.
Yeah, I do like two or three book signings a month. I sell a lot of books. Right now for me, it's just getting those social media contacts. I walked into an event last week, and it was like, wow, these are people I haven't seen pre-COVID. These are people my age and older. And you thought I was President Obama or something. I'm walking there. Everybody is hugging and kissing and shaking. Hey, Doc, how you doing? Oh, man, thanks for coming by. Oh, we've seen your advertising. We've seen your book. I bought a book. Can I go and get it? And you autograph it for me? It took me 20 minutes between handshakes and greetings in a place that I haven't been to in years just to, show up and feel comfortable.
So bottom line, it's still about connecting with people, right? And you know what? You can always buy likes if you really want to feel like a social media star. All right, thank you. Stephen L. Cumnock is a retired counselor, professor, and lecturer on working with the deaf and hearing impaired in Arkansas. And now he's published Life's Handbook to Happiness. And one of his favorite topics is, do you want a job or do you want a career?
Well, I had written this book because I noted that people come into the counseling did not have the fundamental information for a happy and successful life. So I chose the top 20 reasons and solutions that they came in to see us. And often people would come describe what they thought were the problems when in fact it was the symptoms of the problem. A good example of this is a young couple thinking that a divorce was the only solution to their nightly fights, depression, financial trouble, and unhappy family life with their kids suffering as a result of the environment in the house. And in many of the cases, after testing, do you want a job or do you want a career? Both were in the wrong career. She was a bill collector and he was a factory worker, when in fact, after testing, it was noted she needed to be working with children and he needed to be a mechanic. So we drove up a three-year plan for them to change careers. They ended up extremely happy. Their kids' grades improved as well as their attitude. And it was also noted that he was raised without a father in the household and never learned to be the man of the family or a good husband or a great father. So that's also a solution in the book, is how to overcome these things. So everyone needed to understand if you became happy in your life, then your family and your children did too, and they carried this on to their family. And one thing that I like to remind people is how many times that you've heard somebody say, well, if I knew then what I know now. So Life's Handbook to Happiness is really what you need to know now. And the chapters are written very simply. It's not 160 pages to understand a problem and a solution. I try to keep the pages down to 6 to 8 to make it easy for people to follow and read and understand and change their life. The do you want a job or do you want a career I had printed separately. And every time I go through a drive-through window at Burger King or go out to eat, I carry that chapter with me. And I find people that I say, well, what do you know, is this going to be your career? No. Well, what do you want to do? I don't know. And so I hand them that chapter and tell them, said, look, you follow what's in this chapter and you'll know what career that you need. So one of the fathers hired me to work with his son. He had been in college for a couple of years, changed careers 3 times, still didn't know what he wanted to be. And he came in and tested him. And turns out he'd really make a great jet mechanic. And so I showed him the opportunities of the Air Force where he could see the world. And he was single and really liked the idea of the Air Force training him, give him a big paycheck, and traveling around the world. And he signed up for the Air Force, and his father came and gave me a $5,000 bonus. And I said, well, what's this for? And he said, you saved me countless semesters at the university, just a small portion of what you saved me. And so I'm sending this to libraries and to school counselors. This is really a lot of stuff that they ought to be teaching in high school, and they don't. You know, I get kids working with all the time that don't know what a checkbook is.
You know what? We hear that all the time, especially from teachers frustrated because they have to teach to the test, always have to teach to the test, and they aren't able to teach kids, you know, skills they're really going to need in life. Thank you, Stephen. How about some true civility? You think we could use some of that? I mean, after the last couple of years, the politicization of a pandemic, political outrage from both sides, Louisa Akizo and Maureen Ajuda, master civility trainers, are hoping to teach us through workshops in person and online how to be kind to each other, regardless of what we believe or where we come from.
Civility, I would say, is gracious goodness. Being able to pay attention to other people, civility is apologizing honestly if you have to, putting yourself on the other side of the table. What if this was happening to me? How would I feel? So civility is more than politeness, it's more than etiquette. So my best definition of civility is the one for me. And that is that civility is an attitude of benevolence, is an instinct towards kindness, a preference for courtesy, and most importantly, acknowledgement that everyone else is as important as we are. So the book is True Civility. And what we've been able to do with the book is really to break down civility and teach it in through different scenarios. So get people to see how this can be practiced. So what is civil in one context might not be civil in another context. So taking into consideration different people's culture, you know, it requires for us to apply restraint, respect, responsibility, regardless of whatever culture, whatever religion, whatever race, and just how different scenarios, how different things have played out, and how people were able to walk through it and the best ways for them to have handled the situations. And that's what we did with the book.
Isn't it sad that we need to be taught civility?
Absolutely. It is extremely sad that we need to be taught civility. Growing up for me, I thought that everyone knew this. You know, I came from a polygamous family. My parents are Africans. And so in my case, it was just one man with two wives. Well, thankfully. And what happens, you're exposed to very intense environments. And I remember growing up as a little child, and my mom always said to me, no, you do not have to pay back or return the same level of rudeness. You have to be conscious and intentionally be good to other people. Growing up, I thought she was crazy. I was thinking, why do I have to be good to someone who is not good to me? And she said, you have to do this. I felt like I was compromising what I really wanted to do. I realized that sticking to being civil could do so many great things for you. You know, it could expose you to favors, right? It could make you more approachable. It could open doors for you. And people would want to be around you. You'd be able to build a lot better relationships. And of course, when I grew up and finished school and started working, I realized that that didn't exist in the society. So it seemed like there was something wrong with me. And I'm thinking, why is this person behaving like this? Why is the people are so rude? Why is customer service so poor? Why don't people know how to relate to you? And this is what really inspired me to think of other ways to communicate this to other people. And then I realized that what I thought was common sense wasn't really common. And so I had to go back to school to learn how to teach people how to have common sense. And that's what we did with the book. Right now, people are a lot more impatient and have really, along the line, lost their, you know, connection and compassion for one another. So what a better time for us to introduce this back again in our world today.
All right. True Civility. Find out more on Facebook, LinkedIn, and at SoYouUniqueExperts.com. Althea Quill trains horses, wanders the mountains, builds custom log furniture, and then she had this random weird dream that brought her back to writing years after she first discovered it in high school and how calming it could be. Now that dream is detailed in her book, Dreamers and Ranches.
It starts out with Derek. The main character in the book. He grew up with an abusive father and ended up dropping out of school to take care of his sisters and his mom, but always dreamed of being a cowboy, not the typical one that, you know, shoots up the saloon and gets the girl at the end, but has his cows and a good woman to come home to. And he finds out that his grandfather has a ranch and he inherits it because tradition states that the male heir gets it. So he gets to find out all of these things about his mom and how she grew up, and they go out there to learn about the ranch and for him to take over running it. And another main character, Jenny, comes in, and she actually was able to grow up on the ranch, and they become friends, and she helps him to learn about this lifestyle and turn the ranch into a success.
Okay, so, but for it to be a good story, there has to be conflict, right?
There is. There's actually two. Derek deals with the ghosts of his past from his dad and whether or not he can successfully do this, because what good person has their dad walk out on them and it comes from an abusive home is kind of his line of thinking. So he's dealing with some self demons and trying to decide, you know, is this really something I can do? And comes to find out that the ranch hands on the ranch are actually a family, and they kind of help him along and help him. And Jenny actually has an ex-boyfriend that shows up on the ranch, and the family comes together and chases him away, and they all just support each other.
You could probably do a series on this, couldn't you?
Yes, my brother-in-law called me and went, the next book's about which one was it? Rose, one of the sisters. I said, you know, I don't know yet. I haven't got there yet.
I mean, because you have this family is rich. It's got a lot of depth and they're real people. So who's going to play you in the Netflix miniseries? That's what I want to know.
Boy, it better be somebody with hell on her tail, because that's gonna have to be who it is.
No, really. I mean, how are you telling people about this?
So most of it's by word of mouth. I've got a fairly large network and cheer group, and I've given them each little snippets. And then when I decided to take the leap and get it published, I told a couple of my closest friends. And before I knew it, a couple of weeks later, a bunch of my other friends came to me and they're like, well, when is it coming out? When can I buy my own copy? I said, okay, well, that answers that. And it has just grown into this huge thing. I have a family of roughly 400 brothers and sisters, because I'm in a very unique niche. And they have all shown support for this to carry on and actually turn into a series.
Wait a second. Why do you have 400 brothers and sisters?
Because I'm also in the military. They're not really my brothers and sisters, but we're a unique family.
Yeah, that's unique and lucky. That is a lot of people reading and talking about your book. We should all have a network like that. All right, Althea, thank you. Oh, is that it? Is that all there is? Sounds like a song. Is that all there is? That's all she wrote for this edition of the Page Publishing Book Club. You can find out more about our authors and their books at pagepublishing.com. You can buy the books at amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, and other fine online booksellers. And you can listen to all of our shows as many times as you want when you download the podcast at 710WOR.com. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Alice Stockton Rossini. I will catch you next time.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.